Hey everyone, and welcome to this special feature interview edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This podcast was made possible thanks to the support of the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative. They've provided us with some grant funding so we can do feature podcasts that will be of interest to people working in policy roles. The idea is to educate people working in policy about issues that they're in a position to do stuff about. And in this feature interview, we're talking about the blockchain. More specifically, we're talking about how to observe criminal activity on the blockchain. I gave myself an open brief going into this interview, and the whole thing hinges on the idea that there's this incredible data set, namely the blockchain, the ledger, that allows us to have fairly extraordinary insight into things like ransomware and dark markets. Kim Grauer is the head of research at Chainalysis. And I'd just like to note too that this isn't a sponsored interview. We don't have any sort of commercial relationship with Chainalysis. I just thought this would be a cool interview. So Chainalysis makes software that cryptocurrency exchanges, regulators, law enforcement, and intelligence services use to get insight into what's happening in terms of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies moving around. So an exchange might use it for compliance purposes, law enforcement and intelligence might use it in investigations, that sort of thing. Now, you would have heard us talk about about some of the Chainalysis reports in the news segment of the Risky Business Podcast a few times, because they have a habit of publishing really interesting insights and findings into things like the ransomware economy. So, as I said, like this interview didn't start out with a conclusion in mind. Like, it didn't start out trying to go anywhere in particular, but I wound up taking away a number of things from it in the end. So firstly, one of my takeaways was some criminals are incredibly blasé about the way that they use Bitcoin and they leave really obvious trails. So that's one thing that I learned. And, you know, partially that's because they're not so worried about being extradited from places like Russia and North Korea. Secondly, there are some serious weak points in the ransomware economy. Chiefly, Bitcoin laundering services aren't actually that numerous. And thirdly, cryptocurrency regulation and anti-money laundering compliance regimes, they feel like they might at least start to make things a bit harder for crooks in the future. So yeah, there's a few things that I took away from this. But again, you know, we didn't start the interview with a specific destination in mind. Anyway, I'll drop you in here where Kim is explaining why the blockchain is a powerful data set when you want to understand illicit activity. Here she is.
There is no equivalent data set anywhere else. There's no one data set where you can go and say, give me in one central place all of the transfer level activity involving cybercrime. Let's pull in the darknet market transfers where they're purchasing access. Let's pull in the wallets of the actual bad actors. Let's also pull in the money laundering infrastructure into one place and just run a query on all the transfers connecting all that up. That doesn't really exist anywhere else. So this is a very special data set. In terms of cybercrime in general and where we're at today when it comes to ransomware, the ransomware ecosystem pretty much exploded in 2020. It grew over 300% in terms of the payments identified as being paid to ransomware individuals. And there's a lot of reasons why we think that is.
I'd love to hear those reasons, by the way. Tell me what you think those reasons are.
Okay, so we have a few reasons. One is COVID. All of a sudden, we have an entire workforce that has to overnight basically go and become a remote workforce. And operationally, that is a difficult thing to do. But there's also other things at play. We noticed that one thing that ransomware criminals are using to get people to pay more ransoms is something called the double extortion. So maybe you're hit by a ransom.
The Klopp stuff where they threaten to leak your documents and all of that.
Yeah. So you're kind of more incentivized. Let's say you have a philosophy or you're advised by the FBI to not pay a ransom, but you now face this other threat of, I don't want my sensitive documents to be released. It's just another incentive. And then finally, one thing that I do want to talk more with you about is we saw just a sophistication in the ransomware service ecosystem, where more payments that we're identifying that are being received between affiliates that are carrying out these ransomware payments, and a sophistication in the way that they run their organizations that have allowed them to scale more effectively. And what that might look like is, if you look at some of the ways they're attacking people, there is a lot more investment in the way the attack is carried out. There's a process of where you can purchase every step of the ransomware attack on a darknet market forum, or apply to be an affiliate of a major strain. And this is really facilitating the ransomware's ability to scale much faster, because you don't anymore need just the ransomware developer to carry out the attack. You actually have a great business model that's running efficiently.
This stuff, I mean, it was around before, but it does seem like that whole economy has really codified, and that's allowed that to scale, right? It does seem like it's become much more, there is a way things are done. Whereas previously people might do a few side deals and this and that and cooperate on various things. Now it is a completely sort of distributed chain, isn't it? Up and down the attack. You got your initial access brokers, you got your malware authors, you got your distributors, you got, you know, it seems like it's an established business now, whereas previously it was a little more ad hoc.
We're able to model that out, which is really cool in blockchain. So we're able to see, okay, so here was the ransomware payment. What's happening after a ransomware payment is paid to the wallet? What happens after? Well, actually, you can observe the way that the ransomware business is working. So what we'll often see after a ransom is paid is a splitting effect. So for example, oftentimes a small percentage, a very defined percentage, will go to the admin. Maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 15% of the payment. So we know over here this is the admin. Who else are they connected to? Okay, so 60% we know with Soda Bocchini is going to the affiliate. And then the remainder will be maybe to someone selling access. And then from there we can see, oh, we know this affiliate is using this, you know, cloud service provider. And we see Bitcoin or cryptocurrency is being moved between these. This is where they're buying their hosting services. And over here we have them connecting with a darknet market or a darknet forum, where maybe they're purchasing access. And then
at this point, I got to stop you, and I just got to ask. I mean, mm-hmm. That seems really dumb on their part to not be running it through six tumblers first, right? Like, why are they doing this stuff in the open? Is it just a case that they're brazen, or do they not realize the extent to which this behavior is observable?
I think there's a little bit of brazenness there. And I think that, you know, we don't know exactly what is going on. I mean, a lot of these, it hasn't gotten to the money laundering stage yet, where then you do start to see the need to obfuscate. And this is also not comprehensive. There are other ways of managing the money in a ransomware attack. This is, but we do observe this splitting, especially among certain strains.
So you might not have like an end destination for that, for those coins, but you can see the proportions that it's been split into, and you know that, well, at that address, which we don't know who owns that address, but at that address, you know, this amount went. But I guess what I'm wondering is, like, how often is it the case that someone takes a ransom payment and they just send 10% to some crime forum's like publicly published wallet address? Does that happen?
The attributions that we have on darknet marketplaces are extremely hard won. It's one of the more difficult fields or types of services to gain attribution on. And so it's not just a public address that anyone can know about that they're interacting with. These are forums that we've done our homework on. If there's a transfer to a wallet and we don't know what it is, we haven't done our homework to figure out what it is, then you're in the realm of, let's make assumptions around what we think is happening. And you know, if there's this consistent splitting pattern that's in the same exact percentages when it comes to this strain, and we know it's this strain, we are a little bit confident that this is probably the affiliate, and this is other here is probably over here is probably the admin. But then these individuals, they haven't cashed out yet. There might even be an algorithm baked into the ransomware address that automatically splits things off. Because I mean, I don't know. Can you trust your fellow criminal that they're going to give you 15% or 10% of the, so we have seen that this might be actually just baked into the contracts that they're using. But after that is when you do have to launder money. And mixers are a big part of this situation. We do know mixers are used a lot. So from there, the affiliate who uses a darknet marketplace, one thing that it didn't make it into the crime report this year, but I actually find it really fascinating. There's more than ever before activity between illicit entities. So from ransomware to darknet marketplaces, that activity is going up really fast. And so, you know, and to some degree it is because activity in general is going up, but these connections being formed between bad actors and the darknet marketplaces and kind of like the supply chain of crime that they're able to do, because they can do it on cryptocurrency and on blockchain, there's less times they need to cash out. And those cash out times are like kind of the dangerous times where you might make a mistake or get caught. So yeah, it's more and more of this activity is ideally happening on the blockchain, so you can avoid those cash out points as much as possible.
Yeah, so you build up some holdings and then you might just do a cash out when you got a bunch at once, which I guess is in some ways riskier if something goes wrong, because you know you're going to lose a lot all at once. But in other ways, yeah, you're sort of minimizing the number of transactions that can be traced to you. At this point, it would probably make sense for us to explain what a tumbler is, or a mixer, as you called it. You know, that's when someone's operating basically, yeah, what we call a tumbler or a mixer. So a bunch of parties will transfer, say, 10 Bitcoin each, and then they get sort of randomized, jumbled up, and then spat back out to those people, and they might get, you know, they get the equal number of coins back less a fee taken by the tumbler person, and now you don't know whose coins are whose. Now, that's the theory with a tumbler. The thing is, the people who tend to use them at scale tend to be the ones committing the crimes, so it's probably not giving them the anonymity that they would like. That's my understanding, but you're the expert. Is that the case, or are mixers still quite effective?
I do think that there is a little bit of a growing suspicion of mixers. And at this point, a compliant exchange might have to have an honest question about what's my risk appetite when it comes to me accepting money from what Chainalysis has identified as a mixer. What's my risk appetite?
Oh, so how that's much- interesting. So so some of these exchanges are actually just banning transfers from some of these mixers and tumblers.
I don't know what their policies are, but I do think that compliance is more of it's an art. So if there's a person who's receiving money from in a certain kind of suspicious manner. So maybe I know there are some tells of money laundering where an account will, let's say an account receives $1,000, immediately sends out $1,000, receives $1,000, immediately sends out. That's a suspicious pattern. And let's say you add mixing into the mix, then a compliance officer might say, you know what, I want to ask a few more questions. There's not oftentimes, very rarely in compliance is there like a very straightforward, except if you're receiving money from, you know, terrorist financing addresses. So oftentimes it's you have to make a judgment about who is this person and what are they doing. But maybe there's a trader who does millions of dollars and they use mixers, and that the risk appetite of the compliance officer is such that they're fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing that's interesting too is, if you're going to trust a tumbler, you got to hope that nobody has insight into the internal operations of that tumbler, either because they hacked it, you know, so say Cyber Command or someone like that could go along and own a bunch of mixers, and then they would have insight into which coins went where, and then the mixer has done absolutely nothing of use. There is also the possibility that the mixer that you're using is operated by law enforcement, so there's that, that's not going to give you a result.
Yeah. I know. And also, is it a scam? You know, if I'm laundering money and I send it to a mixer and they don't do anything, they don't give it back to me, what's your my recourse? Legal recourse?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that's interesting, right? Because I'd imagine, and I don't know about this, that's why I'm asking you, but I'd imagine that, you know, like dark marketplaces, after people build up a certain amount of value in those dark marketplaces, they do an exit scam, just close the whole thing down and disappear. I imagine it would be the same for Tumblr's, right? That they build up that trust and then eventually someone sends them a transfer for mixing that's just too big to resist. You know, they send them $10 million and they just say, thank you, we're not going to be a Tumblr anymore, bye-bye.
Yeah, and that happens in exchanges too. Or yeah, that happened in DeFi this year too. Actually, if you looked at, we did a whole section on hacking. There's a ton of the most ever hacks. Although there was not, it wasn't the most value ever hacked. There were just a ton of things like this happening with DeFi, where people baked into the code, or they basically, it's called pulling the rug out, where they baked into the code a backdoor where maybe they have an escrow. So you send money to a DeFi contract, it's held in escrow for 24 hours, and then it will be released. That's what you think is happening. But in reality, baked into the code is a way for the people running this to leave with the funds. So it wouldn't be the first time that's happened.
Yeah. So cash out is the, well, tumbling, laundering, and cash out is the tricky bit. But I guess, you know, you mentioned earlier that this is about entities, right? And just following the money around and sort of inferring from things like amounts and splits, like what that money is for. But you can actually get pretty close to people's end identities, right? So you can say, provide a list of addresses and say, well, look, if you had the data from this mixer and the data from this exchange, you would know, you would have a much better idea of who this person is. So it does get you close to the end targets of investigations, this sort of analysis, right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's a useful tool. It's a big part of the puzzle, in terms of if you're interested in tracking a certain crime, you would need blockchain analytics. If you wanted to go from having a ransomware address towards the off-ramp, you would need to be able to know what to do with that payment, unless you wanted to rely entirely on off-chain data, but, you know, follow the money. And this is cryptocurrency. So you'd have to use blockchain analytics to get close to the place to go, which is the place where you're going to ask the next series of questions and hope to get closer to the identity there.
Yeah, no, it makes 100% sense. So I got to ask at this point, I mean, you know, I've been talking about Bitcoin, Bitcoin, Bitcoin. Is it all about Bitcoin? I mean, I know some people, you know, as part of their laundering strategy, they will swap their Bitcoin for a whole bunch of different coins and then maybe back into Bitcoin. And that's one thing that they can do. But I'd imagine that, you know, that's also not going to be the most difficult thing to track. But I guess I'm wondering, like, how much focus do you put on coins that aren't Bitcoin?
We track hundreds of cryptocurrencies and apply the same, what we call, attribution to all of the chains that that we decide to take on, which means that if you use our software and you go into any of these cryptocurrencies, you would have a built-out sense of the exchange activity, the darknet market activity. So there's criminal activity happening on a number, obviously not all of the chains. There's, I think we put the details of which cryptocurrencies are applicable to which types of crime in the crime report. We follow Bitcoin Cash, Tether, ETH, Litecoin. Stablecoins are a big part of this money laundering narrative as well. And that allows us to follow what's going on beyond Bitcoin. However,
but Bitcoin is king, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
however, Bitcoin is king.
Yeah. Yes. So my question was going to be, like, you know, we've seen various, you know, privacy preserving cryptocurrencies sort of floated, right? Zcash or Zerocash is one of them. I'm guessing a switch to that paradigm is going to make life a lot harder, not just for you, but for law enforcement, for intelligence. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, share with us your thoughts about these privacy preserving cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, they're definitely a part, you know, that we have a lot of R&D efforts that we're staying on top of. And in terms of it does pose a huge challenge. Of course, it's a huge challenge. It's similar to mixing. Who's accepting the privacy coins? what's the liquidity for Monero? If you are a hacker and you, or not a hacker, if you are a ransomware individual and you have $100 million in ransoms in Monero to launder, you have a liquidity problem and you're going to have trouble getting rid of all of that. And maybe you're up for the task, but exchanges might increasingly delist Monero. I don't know. I think I've heard a little bit about that happening. I think that there is an industry answer to the problem of privacy coins, but it's definitely, I mean, every single year there's a new challenge for what we're doing, whether it be decentralized darknet marketplaces or privacy coins or chain hopping, Lightning Network. Like this is a challenging space to stay on top of.
So I guess what I'm getting at is Bitcoin is easy mode, right? So why are they using Bitcoin and not something? And obviously, when I asked you that question, I missed the obvious example of Monero. Yeah. We're talking about privacy preserving coins, but why aren't they just saying, send us Monero? Why are they not making a decision as a block to get people to pay ransoms into something that's going to give them better protection out of the gate? Like, it just seems stupid to me for them to be going for the most traceable digital currency as a payment for their crimes, right? Like, what the hell?
Okay, I think I have a few thoughts on that. One is we do see some are turning to Monero. And I forget the name of the branch that officially, the strain that officially announced, like in a public statement, we are now only accepting Monero. So it is happening. But it still is mostly in Bitcoin. I think there's one component of that is if you're going to ransomware attack someone, try explaining them how to use Monero. Yeah. Bitcoin is, you just tell them, you go do this process. It's easy. You go do this process and do it now and be on with it. And then there's also a little bit of maybe, and I don't, this is me just having conversations with certain people about this topic. It's definitely not my domain of expertise, but a lot of the cybercrime that's been identified as being based coming out of Eastern Europe, you know, maybe there's a little bit of an impunity
they don't
factor
care.
There.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's also like, yeah, as you pointed out, liquidity, right? You're never going to have trouble selling Bitcoin. Whereas, yeah, 100 million in Monero, good luck.
And another thing is we know, like, for example, we track some of the hacking groups out of North Korea, like the Lazarus Group. We know they don't care about getting caught or not. We know they just want to get the fastest way to move money as fast as possible. So maybe in 6 months after a hack, people will be able to be like, yep, we figured it out. That's the Lazarus Group. But they don't care. They got the money. No, they're on to the next thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, just speaking of that, because you're saying, well, a lot of people don't care about being tracked because, you know, they're in jurisdictions where they can't be extradited, essentially, places like Russia, places like North Korea. Not that those two places are at all equivalent, but I guess my question is, how effective are the laundering strategies used by a lot of these people? Because I just get the sense that they're reasonably effective, but maybe not as effective as those people think they are.
I am really glad you got us into laundering. It's one of the most fascinating parts of what I do is thinking about laundering strategies. And one of the things that we did in the crime report this year is we put all of our wallets together that we know are illicit, and we can just ask our data. You know, we don't like ask it directly. We like we query it. Where are all those funds winding up? And then we're able to see the deposit addresses on exchanges where these funds are gravitating to. And a lot of these, the headline number for the report was actually 55% of all the funds moved in 2020 went to just 270 deposit addresses, which are, each of those deposit addresses were moving more than $1 million. This is a money laundering infrastructure. These are people who are in the business of moving money. These are people who we've identified. You go onto a darknet forum, they you find an advertisement. They say, we will give you KYC credentials. We will move money for you. This is a business. And you know, this is evolving fast. So last year, the ecosystem looked a lot different. There wasn't as much money going to these really large bad deposit addresses that are clearly servicing, clearly made in the business of moving dirty money. And some of them are you go and they have a front website. So I can't give the names of any of them, but they look like a service. But actually,
why aren't they randomizing the wallet addresses? Like, why?
Well, of course, some of them are.
Yeah.
And probably an interview like this is going to make them do it more. I mean, it's a line I constantly toe with the research we do. It's like, how much education do we want to do? Because people will evolve their strategies. And of course, and some exchanges, it's just how exchanges are working right now.
I know, but I mean, you see what I'm getting at, right? Like with my previous question as well, which is it seems like they're all on lazy mode and they don't quite realize how observable their behavior is. Either that or they just don't care. And I guess what you're saying is it's a little bit in column A, a little bit in column B.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we're not capturing all of the criminals who are doing the more advanced stuff, like you said. And also, I heard once from, I was talking to someone in law enforcement where they I can't remember, but they said something like, yeah, the people they end up going after are always the ones who were a little bit, you know, lazy or sloppy. Those are because they're the ones who made the mistakes and they're the ones who they can actually kind of go after. So...
Well, look, okay, that's a great lead into this next question, which is, you know, one thing, I mean, the reason that I really wanted to talk to you is because the work that you've done has really demonstrated that the ecosystem isn't as big necessarily and distributed necessarily as people would think, okay? You've got a high concentration of ownership of these illicit assets, right? Like there's a small clique of people, and you've also been able to identify shared infrastructure, certainly around, you know, exchanges, money laundering, things like that, that look to me, to anyone who's like taking a critical view of that ecosystem and would like it to be destroyed. I mean, it seems like the work you've done has been very effective at identifying weak links in the criminal ecosystem. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
By weak links, do you mean just points where we should direct law enforcement and say, go.
Yeah. Yes, well, not just law enforcement. I mean, there are other agencies that have other abilities that could be directed towards things like offshore tumblers, for example. I can't imagine the legal authorities there would be too hard for a number of countries that operate, you know, very good agencies. So yeah, but that's basically it, right? Like you can say, here are 200 entities that if you disrupted them would cause all sorts of trouble for a very large amount of crime.
And you speak to another point as well, which is like, I think we talked about this earlier on, but how much money laundering is there happening using fiat? No one has any idea.
Yeah.
No one has any idea. The estimates that are out there are, you know, people will openly say that's pretty much just a guess. I'm guessing. And because they're based on cases and then some assumptions you're making about what you think the bottom line is going to be.
I'm sure there are some money launderers out there who are big time, right? And enabling a lot of bad stuff, but we don't have a transparent blockchain that points us towards them. I guess my point is there seems an opportunity here to go after a limited number of actors and cause disproportionate effects to an entire ecosystem of badness.
I totally agree. I mean, I'm like this finding on the money laundering section. I'm sitting there and I'm saying this is money laundering. This is it. This is the world, you guys. We can count to 270, can't we? You know, we can. It's finite. It feels actionable.
And of those 270, I mean, there would be common operation. There would be a handful of operators probably operating all of those, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've just from off-chain intelligence and investigations, we know many of them are connected to each other. So we know like a few of them are operated by the same group, and we know that through, you know, external intelligence. But it's just what we happen to know. What do we not know about how connected the other ones are? And so I do think it's really a powerful point to give people a list of this is money laundering. Yeah. This is the world. This is how big it is.
From what you're saying, it seems that you're saying that is the obvious weak point here, is instead of targeting the criminals directly, you know, you might want to go after the laundering infrastructure because it is a weak point.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that if we could, you know, of course you have the counterpoint of people will just evolve. So are you just making your life even harder down the road? But, you know, right now there is an opportunity to, to make connections that you wouldn't have otherwise been able to make before between different types of crime, between bad actors that might be connected, between how the fiat system they're using. We've seen a few cases in this report of traditional money laundering rings, and we highlight one out. It's actually kind of funny. I can tell you a little bit about it, but basically it involves a fancy retail department in London being used to smuggle drugs. So what happened was basically there's this drug distribution ring. It's a drug cartel, and actually involves Australia. The way they would get the drugs to Australia was someone would go in and buy a really luxury furniture item from Harrods in London, take it home, fill it with drugs, return it. The next day, someone in Australia would buy that item. So this is unrelated to crypto.
And then Harrods, because it's a not often sold item, you would get the same item and it would be what, dispatched to Australia, and then Harrods have smuggled your drugs for you.
Exactly. And so it's genius, I know. And so this is an operation that's been going on for a long time, but they introduced cryptocurrency. So their payments, whereas the payments before would have been using wire transfers, international money transfers, now they're happening using cryptocurrency. And this is the type of activity that we can't see on the blockchain, because what we call the source of illegality was off-chain. They just transferred onto Bitcoin for layering. And so this is happening. The money laundering component here is a big part of this whole story, and how it plugs into the financial ecosystem. More and more people might be catching on to this.
Now, look, there is one last thing that I want to briefly talk about before we ring off, and that is that there have been some recent proposals from the bowels, the depths of the US government, which talk about sort of applying regulation, like AML controls, basically, to self-hosted wallets, right? Is this something that you're across? I can't remember which entity it is that proposed it, but it's the idea is even a self-hosted wallet, like if it's going to be handling more than 10 grand, it needs to be, if an exchange wants to do business with it, they need to verify the identity of the wallet holder, even if it's not with another exchange, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like a really pretty heavy type of regulation to be throwing on Bitcoin. But yeah, I just wondered, A, if you were aware of that proposal, and B, what you thought of it.
I am aware of that, and I do agree that it does seem overburdensome. My understanding is it's more than the fiat equivalent would be required to do. So it does seem like a proposal that's asking a lot of a new industry.
Yeah.
And while I can't answer exactly how is this bad, what should they do, what are the alternatives, I do know that maybe that is born out of a lack of data, a lack of understanding how cryptocurrency is used, a fear around who even is the crypto user. And that's a lack of data. So we're talking about a data problem here. We're talking about a need to educate regulators that, in 2020, less than 1% of all activity was associated with illicit activity. Okay, so you have questions about unhosted wallets. Let's get you answers. What do you want to know about these people? What do you want to know? And providing and empowering regulators with the right data to help them come to the right conclusions, I just see it as kind of born out of a lack of understanding of how crypto is used. I don't know if that is that. That's
no, no. Look, I mean, that is obviously a perspective that comes from working with this stuff. And what's really weird is, and I don't know how I'm getting this inference, but it feels uh-huh. like you quite enjoy being elbows deep in blockchain stuff, right? Like it feels like this is an ecosystem that you enjoy working in.
On a personal level?
Yeah.
I do.
You seem enthusiastic about it is what I'm saying. You can tell when someone's talking about work and work is work, but you like this.
I do really like this. I'm in too deep in the crime report. I'm like, I find it exciting, and I find it to be one problem after the other that might have a fun solution. So, yeah.
Okay, well, Kim Grauer, thank you so much for joining us on the show to walk through, a whole bunch of blockchain stuff there. I'm sure a lot of the listeners found it very interesting. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
That was Kim Grauer there from Chainalysis. Big thanks to her for that, and big thanks to the Hewlett Foundation for supporting this work. And that is it for this special edition of the Risky Business Podcast. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in a couple of days with the weekly show, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.